So thank you all for coming. We're going to get right into it. Secrets of brain health. Can you see that well? So we want to just let you know we just bought this book so that we can write down, if you would give us your contact information, if you want copies of our slides, if you want, we'd like to keep in touch with all of you to sort of start a movement of brain health, right? So again, we've been praying for you before this seminar, and we're continuing to pray for you and your ministry and your church. So just give us your contact information if you want more information as we have it and the lecture series here today. So we need to get right into it today. We have a lot of material, so we're going to ask that you keep your questions to the end so that we can have plenty of time to get through all the material. We'll try to leave enough time for questions. And if you have a question, just jot it down so that we can get that question on the mic so everyone can hear it, and then we can give you the best answer we can on that. So today we're going to talk about the next two items, which is exercise and resting. So just to get you started with the types of exercise. So there are two basic types of exercise: aerobic exercise and resistance type of exercise. Aerobic exercise, like rowing, running, brisk walking, swimming, cycling, aerobics. These improve the rate of oxygen volume delivery into the tissue and into your brain, and elicits the sprouting of new neurons. So neurogenesis, we're going to talk about that again, just like we did yesterday. Also, you're using the slow twitch, the type 1 muscles, when you're doing aerobic exercise generally. Now, when you're doing resistance training, when you're lifting weights, doing push-ups, these type of training, you're improving your muscle tone and strength. And you're improving your performance in everyday activities, improving your posture and circulation. And muscle activity like this triggers the energy expenditure, and Sam is going to talk about a little bit more about that in a few minutes. So you're releasing certain proteins from your muscle, and it's going to your brain. So you're actually improving your brain with resistance training as well. And you're improving the health of these fast twitch neurons, of the fast fibers of the muscle. So you need both. Well, aerobic training heightens your mood by releasing endorphins. It is also effective as an antidepressant. It lowers blood pressure, improves your cholesterol and triglyceride levels. It boosts your immune system so that you don't get sick as much, you get sick less often, and it keeps your mind sharp by promoting, we talked about this yesterday, brain-derived neurotrophic factor. It helps you to lose weight by expending calories and reduces your risk of heart attack, stroke, and cancer. The benefits of resistant exercise are increasing your range of motion, improving your joint function, producing fuel for your brain by increasing fat metabolism, increasing your bone density. So your muscles release chemicals that improve your bone density and improve your balance and your posture, reducing injuries. So which is better? Well, we think both are important, both resistance and aerobic activity. So if you really want to know, okay, what is aerobic? How do I know if I'm getting enough aerobic activity? This is just kind of a chart of what you should target as a heart rate depending on your goals. So if you're looking just to maintain your healthy heart, you would take your maximum heart rate. You figure that out by taking 220 and subtracting your age. So for me, 220 minus 45 is 75. So 175, sorry. So 175 is my maximum target heart rate. And then if I want to do like increase my stamina, if you multiply that by 0.7, you'll get a target heart rate around 140. 120 to 140 is my fitness goal as far as increasing my stamina and building fitness. So that's my, would be my target heart rate for depending on my goals. So how does exercise affect your brain?
Very well. Now that we understand what type of exercises we can do, it's very important for us to understand what exercise can do and how it affects the brain. So the literature out there is quite vast. We have a lot of magazines, books, scientific clinical journals that have reported on the benefits of exercise on the mind, on the brain, brain processes. Here we have just an array. Multiply this times 500, more or less. So, and you get the number of publications out there on the effects of exercise on the brain. That's how much attention has exercise gotten lately. Well, I would say in the last 50 years concerning brain health. And this does not stop at any age. It is basically across age, a must needed thing to happen in our lives. When it comes to exercise, what is good for the body is very good for the brain. Keep that in mind. And so right now, bear with me, it's about 4:10. And so I hope you're awake. I'm going to walk you through some physiological mechanisms, because we said we're going to come here, Dr. Crawford and myself, to hopefully share with you something that people don't share with you, which is the actual mechanisms, how things happen. Wouldn't you like to know how it happens? So let's dive into it. So let's talk about the shift of fuel from fat cells to muscles and from muscles to the brain. So basically what we're talking about is this. Exercise makes more fuel available for the brain. How so? Here we go. So in this picture, we have an individual that is biking. Looks like he's mountain biking. Whatever he's doing, he is exerting force on his muscles. So he's exercising those muscles. The muscle fibers, or the myocytes as they're known, those are the muscle cells basically. Each of them activates a factor. It is a transcriptional regulator. It is activator of the genome. It is abbreviated as PGC1-alpha, and this is produced by the skeletal muscle. What happens? This factor right here, and you can see it in blue. I don't know if my pointer is up here. There it is. So I'm going to place my pointer. That's the factor in the picture. It would activate a membrane-bound, another molecule abbreviated FNDC5. You don't have to memorize this. You will not be quizzed. But what the bottom line is that this factor right here, which is membrane-bound, it's an enzyme. That enzyme would make a magical molecule that would go to every part of our bodies, especially the fat cells. It's known as irisin. I-R-I-S-I-N. Irisin. Arising sounds like arousing, right? It's exactly what it does. But it goes, it targets here the white fat cells. So see if I can move my, there it is, white fat. So these are your white fat cells. So I'm trying to point you to where the graphics are. It's early in the day, there's quite a lot of lighting. But you can see that these fat cells are irrigated by the blood vessels, so arising goes here and produces magic. How so? Well, it starts to transform these white cells by their metabolism into brown adipose tissue. You know what that means? Brown adipose tissue is highly active in lipolysis. So lipo fat lysis, breaking down of fats. That's exactly what it does. So that this fat is mobilized and it goes to the muscles to use as fuel. So here's basically what we're saying. Exercise induces a release of orexin into the bloodstream, causing subcutaneous fat to heat up, and the breakdown of fat molecules takes place that fuel can be used. Basically, this is what we can say. How does it happen? So here's a summary. There's the fat cell, there's lipolysis here. The fatty acids are broken down. This is what happens. Fatty acids go into the mitochondrion. There's a beta oxidation of the fats, and this happens in every cell, mostly in the fat cells. This then is produced as glucose by a process known as gluconeogenesis. Also, the liver takes action there. Guess what? Here's glucose. I'm pointing there. The pointer, where the pointer is, glucose. That is fuel for the brain. Remember yesterday, those of you who were here, the brain consumes how many? Do you remember that percentage that the brain consumes? 20% roughly of every glucose intake, everything we eat. And so the brain needs it. That is why when we exercise, we feel more energetic and we can focus more. Well, of course, because the resources from the fat cells have been mobilized and made available for the brain. Tied to this, very, very connected to this, is the fact that the muscle now has become an endocrine organ. Really? Yes, it did, because of orexin, right? It just releases that magic orexin molecule that now mobilized energy resources. So here we have another magic molecule that is present in inflammatory mechanisms or activation. The inflammatory process is IL-6. I don't know if you can read this, but it's IL-6, interleukin-6. How many of you have heard of this molecule? Some of you? It is considered a pro-inflammatory molecule, but wait a minute, isn't inflammation a little not too good for us? Yes, it's not that good. Well, all of us need inflammation, okay? But we don't need it to stay there longer, right? To linger. What happens is this. When in the context of exercise, IL-6 is released into circulation, other pro-inflammatory cytokines or factors are not released, as if in this context, IL-6 will be telling the whole organism, says, look, do not get inflamed to the extent of sickness. He is or she is simply exercising. We need to allocate resources where they need to go. And so what happens? IL-6 signal the adipose tissue here. So more fat cells are broken down into the liver, so more gluconeogenesis is made available, happens, so more glucose is available, and that is how this is beneficial to us. Here's a mode of exercises in this graph right here. We have knee extensor. Those are basically a resistant exercise, bicycling, running, and eccentric. Running happens to release or mobilize more plasma IL-6. This is the release of IL-6 into the circulation than any other type of exercise. So if I haven't convinced you that running is good for you by now, you know that it is, right? How many of you try running a little bit, at least jogging, or at least, brisk walking? That is very good for you. So did you know that exercise makes a difference for older adults and adult individuals more than younger adults? It does. I tell you how. This is a piece of data here. So NF kappa B here in the y-axis, P65, don't be concerned with the lingo, I'll walk you through. Basically, this expression is the presence of this protein, which is part of the complex of inflammation. That's basically all it is. So scientists conducted a groundbreaking study in 2014 in which they compare older non-exercising individuals with older exercising or trained individuals. These were folks ranging in ages between 65 and 80, more or less, that were exercising. Does the bar right here? Let me see if I can find my pointer again. I always kind of wrestle with that. But we're looking at the two columns in the far right. Okay, and so in the middle right here, It is the two bars that correspond to the non-exercises, older adults, and they compare these two groups to younger adults. Okay, young folks. All these were non-exercising. Look what happens when they added salicylate, which is an inhibitor of inflammation of this factor right here. It inhibits the level of this expression of that presence of the protein in the non-exercisers. What does this tell you? Here's basically what it happens. This fluorescence, the pictures are basically telling you that indeed the NF-kappa-B factor of inflammation was decreased in the non-exercisers. Something's happening that makes a difference when you decrease inflammation in non-exercisers that makes your brain makes you better. Okay? Here, no problem. Why? Because though the folks that exercised, the levels are equally to what? To the young one. Notice they both resemble, right? The two bars, don't they resemble? The difference is here for the non-exercisers. Does that mean that you should just eat or ask the doctor to give you salicylate? You can do better than that, actually. You don't need a drug, right? So let me tell you what happens. Notice this picture right here that you've been watching already. Oh, I don't like this, you may wonder. We have a young fellow doing push-ups, and look what happens to Grandpa is next to the TV. So this is a little dramatic. It affects, aging affects all of us. And I include myself because we're not as young as we used to be. And we start having more sedentary behaviors. Why? A lot of you become supervisors. You supervise others. You are not in the field. A few where you are still. Exactly. So you now are the experienced fellow, ladies and gentlemen, and you are now supervising more than actually doing. Well, guess what? That you get a little more tired, maybe less fit, and this is what happened because the arteries change. Here we have the comparison of a young artery versus an old artery, and the older artery gets thicker. There's more leakage of some of the cells there, some lipids also leak, some proteins. So this is what happens in the older artery, and it's just a product of the lifestyles, the diet, the lack of exercise. You get busier. Your schedules don't allow you to exercise as you used to, more worries and so forth. So this is a normal process of exercising. How can you reverse this trend and be exposed to inflammation like this group right here? Here's the secret. Look at that. So behaving as you behave as a young adult, it's important in this case to prevent the thickening of your arteries. And this is beneficial for the brain because after all, we have arterioles and capillaries and the brain. And so I'm going to explain more of that. This brings me to this point right here. How many of you are following me so far? So we're in the thick of the physiology, okay? Isn't that exciting? So everybody can have access to this information. Now, let me explain to you what the neurovascular unit is. Exercise prevents the age-related changes in the neurovascular unit. This is what we have in the brain. So here's a picture. The neurovascular unit is composed of several elements. There's a neuron, the microglia, the astrocytes. The microglia protect the neurons. Some of you may know this. The astrocytes provide factors and nurtures the neuron, helps protect the neuron. And the basilar, this extends into the basilar membranes, which is basically a nice, tight membrane that prevents any leakage of the blood into the brain. All right, so that's nice and tight. The pericytes are there also in pink, nicely lined up, and the endothelium, very healthy. Okay, so age basically causes a disarray in this arrangement. Notice there's a little bit of conglomerates, clumps of these cells, not in a nice arrayed mode or fashion as you see it here. Notice that the basal membrane becomes a little leaky, or severely leaky, depending on the process, the antioxidative stress, and so forth. Few pericytes are there to pack that basilar membrane tightly, and so this is what happens. Well, what prevents this, or what can reverse this? Even reverse, to some extent, research has shown that exercise, aerobic exercise, another point for running or brisk walking, if you will, would prevent this sort of thing from happening. Not prevent, but diminished that onset. So it does it at the cellular level in your brain. That's what we're talking about by the neurovascular unit. Okay? And so all these factors are decreased. These are basically metabolites of produced that, if increased, are very deleterious to the brain. They cause oxidative inflammation in the brain. One last thing before we go to the next that I wanted to mention. Since we're talking about inflammation and oxidative stress, let me mention that exercise enhances the activity of antioxidant enzymes. And it does it not only in the brain, but it does it in other tissues as well. So here's a blown up of your artery. This is an H artery per se, an X someone's artery. What do you see here? So here's the endothelial layer. Here are the red blood cells, right? And the white blood cells right here. And notice this clump of, it's a plaque, basically what we're looking at, right? And so this is basically the result of diet, stress, injury, sedentary behaviors. Unfortunately, this can happen. Some older individuals have less of these plaques than some others, depending on how they take care of themselves, starting, you know, at a young age, middle age, and so forth. Look what happens cellular. So let's concentrate on one endothelium. One endothelium right here in this layer. So let's enhance this, and this is what we're showing here. A research in 2014, this is a review actually, that basically analyzes a conglomerate of various research, a body of research, but also a groundbreaking experiment confirmed those previous researches, research activity, by demonstrating that aerobic exercise in the H endothelium, all right, reverse the effect of aging on the increased oxidative stress and inflammation, and therefore enhance the endothelial dysfunction. That is partially the product of the normal aging. How did it do so? By what mechanism? By this mechanism right here. Notice, SOD and NADH oxidase. These are oxidative enzymes. These are enzymes that take care of the oxygen radicals that are produced. Exercise directly affects the activity of this enzyme, so these enzymes work harder for you. And they're able to buffer the production of radicals, oxygen radicals. So that anybody who practices this type of aerobic exercise can leap over this plaque, as you see this gentleman right there, and keep moving forward towards health. Isn't that what would you like to do? Now that you know the facts of how it works, you are welcome to engage into this. Look at the wonderful nature that we have. If you can take a walk this afternoon, do it. It'll do wonders for your brain. So why don't we, at this point, stretch. It's a stretching time. Let's take 5 minutes. I think we have time. And Rhoda would take over in the second half. So yesterday we said you can stretch.
Stand up,
you can stand up.
And rub your neighbor. Give a back rub, right?
Back rub too is good.
So that you can learn, right? So your brain feels good and you're having meaningful touch, right? Right?
Have your waters? Oh, that's your water. Oh, no, here.
For those of you who came in late, don't forget to give us your information. We'd like to give you material later.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Yeah, on the first page there.
Okay, that's good.
All right. I don't know if that was 5 minutes or not, but we'll get started. I think we still have a lot of material to go. So regenerating and maintaining your brain. So we want to exercise. Exercise is really important. Research has not reached the upper limits of what exercise can do for you. So they did studies for 30 minutes of exercise a day, improve health. Mm-hmm. Right. 60 minutes is even better. 90 minutes is even better. They have not done more than 90 minutes a day, right? So so we need to press the limits of what exercise can do for us and our brains. So exercise induces neurogenesis. We want neurogenesis, right?
Anybody remembers what neurogenesis is, by the way?
Do you remember what neurogenesis is? What is neurogenesis? New cells, right. Growing new cells. And I'm so sorry this is not exactly clear. But here we have a rodent's brain. And you can see as the rodent is aging, neurogenesis is decreasing. Right? But humans don't decrease like that. This is the human brain. So as we age, we still have neurogenesis up into the limits of aging. And this is also, this is in the dentate gyrus part of your brain here. And this is in your olfactory bulb, your sense of smell. So throughout life, at the beginning of life, you have more neurogenesis. And even throughout life, you continue to have neurogenesis. And this is showing basically rodent compared to human. A lot of the studies are done in rodents because obviously no one wants you to do a brain biopsy in a research study, right? You're not going to volunteer for that research study, right? So a lot of these studies are done in rodents, but the human brain has neurogenesis throughout the lifespan. In humans, neuroblasts are present throughout life. And this is what helps us to remember, learn new things, motivation. So comparing, though, again, in a rodent, because humans are not volunteering for this experiment, basically stimulating the growth of new neurons. This is showing a voluntary wheel running experiment where the mouse can get in the wheel and run voluntarily. And what it's showing here is that this is improving neurogenesis and the increased environment. So this is actually showing like an enhanced environment for the rodent, different things for the animal to explore, you know, basically stimulating cognitive processes in the animal. And basically enhanced environment plus exercise equals more neurogenesis. And this is just a picture of how these neurons sprout and then how they're maintained. So enrichment in the environment improves the maintenance of these new neurons. So when we're going to repeat this again, but it's the diet, what you eat. It's also, and we're going to talk about that tomorrow, diet tomorrow, and actually also on Wednesday. And then it's your exercise, what you're doing, and it's also what you're studying, the enrichment in your environment, your learning. Today, you're enhancing and you're supporting your neuronal growth because you're learning new things today, right? So that is, so you see that compared to a deprived environment, the neuron looks like this. And then when you have an enriched environment, you've got healthier neurons. So the more spines, the more connections you have with these neurons, the healthier they are. And this is another example of that. So this is the neuron. And you can see in this neuron here, you've got all these tiny little spines growing. That's what you want. You want a lot of connections in your neuron. So this shows differences between these two states. So this is the controlled neurons, where you get aging and stress, and so you get diminished amount of connectivity there in this neuron. And then in this, we have basically the better, you see more dendrites sprouting there. And so exercise, relaxation, and antioxidants improve the health of these neurons. So essential for neuron survival and differentiation is that is exercise, is the enhanced environment, and we're again talking about this white adipose tissue. Sam was just talking about white adipose tissue versus brown adipose tissue. So the white is just the not very metabolically active. It's not energetic. It's not doing much. The brown is energetic. It's keeping you warm. It's burning energy. It has mitochondria going. So the exercise induces all of that. And this enhances the synaptic generation in the brain and also modulates this synaptic generation. So you need to consolidate the memories as well. And we'll talk about that in a minute too. So with all of these things, we're talking about how exercise ends up with increased neuroplasticity. Neuroplasticity, the health of your brain. We talked about that yesterday in case you weren't here. You want neuroplasticity. You want your brain to continue to grow and change based on your experience. That's how you learn. And you want to always make new connections. So resistance training ends up in enhanced brain plasticity through the mechanism of increased growth factor. And it's also supporting your sex hormones. Then you have enhanced brain-derived neurotrophic factor as well. In aerobic and resistance training, you get microvasculature. You get more of that microvasculature. Microvasculature is basically your blood vessels, and you have, you know, them going down into really small vessels. I have a picture of that tomorrow, but basically, you have so much blood all over your brain and all these little vessels. So you want to improve that microvasculature because that's what decreases over time as you age in the typical kind of American setting where you're eating certain things that aren't good for that and you're remaining sedentary. But you don't have to have this happen. This is what exercise can improve that microvasculature, improve the astrocytes, which are the supporting cells of the neurons. They are feeding the neurons, and you want that angiogenesis. You want those blood vessels to be active and giving nutrition to the neurons and taking away waste from the neurons. And that's what breaks down in Alzheimer's disease. And then flexibility and coordination and also enhances neuroplasticity. Overall, brain-derived neurotrophic factor is the fertilizer for your brain. And you want to maintain your brain highways. Remember, we talked about yesterday how your brain has paths in it. So you're making, every time you have a thought, you create a pattern in your brain. You create a path. You connect neurons. And you want to maintain those pathways in your brain. You want to have a healthy, vibrant brain, just like a healthy, vibrant city, lots of paths, lots of things going on, lots of communication. You don't want to have a depressed brain activity where there's no economic activity going on in the brain. So that's our segment on exercise. Now we're going to sleep. So sleep, we have to have exercise, but we also need to have rest, right? We need rest. So what does rest and sleep do for your brain? So sleep is super, super important. With my patients, I always talk about sleep first. If you don't sleep, your brain will never get better. Your brain actually renews and regenerates all the neurotransmitters when you sleep and takes away a lot of the waste that builds up when you sleep, which we'll detail in a few seconds. So if you don't get sleep, you get irritable, you get problems with your thinking, memory problems, you also get impaired moral judgment. You can't make good decisions. Your immune system goes down, attention problems. I have actually known of people who have been sleep deprived and become psychotic. So they start to hear things, see things. Your perceptions of things diminish. You can also have a higher risk of diabetes, increased risk of heart disease, tremors, body aches. You get gross depression. If you don't sleep, you have an increased risk of obesity. People who have to work night shifts and don't sleep very well have increased chronic medical problems, and they die earlier than people who work normal hours. And so these are the stages of sleep. So we have non-REM sleep, pre-sleep. So REM and non-REM, let's start with that. Rapid eye movement sleep is REM sleep, and that's we're gonna show in a second how that cycles. But rapid eye movement sleep is, stage one before you go into stage two. So it goes stage one, stage two, you're getting into the deeper levels of sleep. Yeah, so I should show that. So basically your cycle from the beginning, when you're wakeful, then you start to get into stage one, stage two, stage three, and then you go into stage four. This is where you really regenerate your neurotransmitters here. And then you go back up and you go into rapid eye movement sleep. And you cycle, you should have at least four cycles throughout the night. So you need those cycles. So that's why you need at least 7 hours of sleep to get all those cycles in. And your brain slows down when you're in non-REM sleep. So this is your non-REM sleep, your brain is slowing down. While you're awake and while you're in REM sleep, you actually have rapid, more wakeful sleep, brain patterns.
All right, so now that we have introduced the sleeping patterns, so now you know that you have to have four of these cycles at least, so it brings you to 7 hours. Why is sleeping important for us? Again, let's go now to the physiology of things, and I'm going to explain the best I can so you can really understand why is this necessary? What happens in the brain that we can benefit from sleep? Sleep drives neurotoxic waste clearance from the brain when we sleep. Here's a picture that shows basically the housekeeping crew in a sleeping individual, and this is exactly what happens in our brains. So here's a study, very amazing study published in Nature around 2014, published in 2015, that shows the clearance of amyloid beta. Amyloid beta is metabolite. It's a waste metabolite produced by the brain during activities. So these metabolite, if it accumulates in the brain, is the one that contributes to the formation of plaques that later can affect some forms of dementia and later lead to Alzheimer's sometimes, if not cleared properly. And the clearance of this metabolites actually is the one of the causes of dementia. So here we have, in this experiment, in orange, these are the awake individuals or sleep-deprived individuals in the orange. And that's the curve for clearance of this metabolite produced that needed to be cleared at night. So notice that the curve is a little more, it's over the green one, which represents those individuals that slept normally. So, and then this other group of individuals that is hid behind the green line in this graph are individuals that were induced to sleep with some anesthetics. It was a cocktail of ketamine and xylazine, two known drugs basically to put you to sleep. And there was no difference between these. So this graph right here on your right represents that. So here's the rate constant that is the physical measurement of how this drug was clear, how rapid it was clear from the system. And notice what happens. And the individuals that were sleep deprived, they were severely or significantly, that rate of clearance was significantly affected. It was slower, much lower than the two groups. Those that slept normally throughout the night and those that were put to sleep by the drug cocktail, right? The anesthetics, no difference there. Does this mean that you should drug yourself every night so you can benefit from this? Well, think about this. We always should allow the brain to function naturally. Would you agree? Sleeping is the way to go then. Imagine here, you've probably been staring at, what does this mean anyway? There's a brain right there in that fish tank. Right? You see that? So that means that, imagine this brain being a fish in a fish tank. It has its own filtering system already in there. And so what happens is that the filtering system is basically the lymphatic system at work. So next time you go to sleep, think about this. And I would tell you this, as the body sleeps, the brain is clearing out all the junk that has accumulated as a result of your daily thinking. And this is basically from a writer, a neuroscientist at the Rochester University. Another saying is another evidence is that these studies have been possible through the advances in techniques that allow for the study to trace where this toxin goes. They actually deposit into the cerebrospinal fluid and out into the lymphatic system. And so that connection is being named, that is the name coined to it, as a lymphatic system. Scientists are creative sometimes, you know, so they come up with these names. But sleeping is good. Another thing that sleeping is good for is the consolidation of memories. How many of you have gone to bed thinking, oh man, I forgot to do this. How can I forget to do this? Or, ooh, I need to do this. So you worry a lot before going to bed. Exactly, it happens to all of us. I should have done this today, or I should have done this today. And so what happens here is that many memories that are stored during the day are not remembered, but critical memory reactivation occurs during sleep. In order for the brain, this is an intrinsic property of the brain, in order to consolidate memories, to enhance that memory and consolidate them into smaller groups of memory, you must sleep. Otherwise, this process does not happen smoothly. So in this graph, let me show you. Here we have the pictures of a mouse, okay, with a puppet or a little rabbit, and he's asleep. So there's two cycles, basically, that this mouse represents. Here's the y-axis is the synaptic strength. Synaptic strength is none other than the working synapse. Remember, Rhoda talked to you about the boutons in the synaptodendritic spines. Those are at work being formed. Some of them are pruned. A lot of them are formed during the day. Those need to be fine-tuned and made into memories that can be handled by the brain. And so, and the wake cycle here, during the day, the synaptic potentiation, learning, and circadian regulation are happening. When you're about to fall asleep, there's an enhanced activity because the brain wants to make you remember as much as you can before you fall asleep. This happens with students, by the way. Students fight off, okay, they want a little more piece of information. Come on, another 20 minutes. And they delay the onset of sleep. That's not good. When you are sleepy, that's when you should go. And we're guilty of that because when we went through school, we try to force ourselves to study no matter what. But the memory consolidation is not being as efficient. What happens when that individual falls asleep during the dark cycle as we see sleep time there? That curve of activity decreases now. So that synaptic synergy, or synaptic establishment of synapses decreases, and the density and strength also decreases back to the levels where they began, right at the beginning, right there. So this curve must be a bell curve of memory consolidation in order to be healthy for you. So do not fight it next time you need to go, you fall asleep, go to sleep. I'm sure most of you do that, right? And so here's a graph. Basically, this is the selective dependent memory consolidation. And here we have, this is basically the selective memories right there. And next is the post-sleep goal. The brain wants to consolidate memories into efficiency, and so it packed them in just fewer groups than it started with. That makes sense, right? You don't need to clutter your mind. The mind doesn't want that. And so what happens in the next graph is that in individuals that sleep well, the relevant memories, and that is what I want to highlight here, the relevant memories are enhanced that red bar. And the other memories in those individuals were sleep deprived in the middle, and in the far right, those that are working during the day is no different. Actually, those memories are the same. There's no difference between them. There's no consolidation of relevant memories. This is enhanced only in the group that sleeps, and this is basically has been demonstrated by neuroscientists. So now you know another reason for sleeping, right? Consolidation of relevant memories. Only the relevant memories shall be kept by the brain. Lastly, I wanted to, in this portion of reasons, neuroscience reasons to tell you why it's good to sleep, is that sleep, you must sleep to forget and sleep to remember. Let me repeat that again. Sleep to forget, yet sleep to remember. Well, it makes sense, because then you can remember the relevant memories, but how does it happen? So here it is. Sleep deprivation affects the emotionally reactivity of the brain. How does it do it? So let's go here. This is in the wake state where memory encoding happens. There's a lot of adrenergic activity. That adrenergic is actually the European word adrenaline. That is the same, adrenaline and adrenergic. The pathways that activate adrenaline are very much enhanced during memory during the day. Okay, because we need to be moving.
So what we talked about yesterday.
Yeah, what did we talk about yesterday?
The hypothalamic pituitary axis, right?
The HPA axis. Some of that, so that's the arousing part of the brain, by the way. So we need that. Too much of it is not good. That's what we talked about, right? So we need to tame it. But our memories work with that system, okay? And so what happens here is this bar, I'm trying to bring my point. There it is. There's a lot of this right there. The cholinergic, that is the parasympathetic. How many of you are familiar with the sympathetic and parasympathetic arm, the autonomic nervous system? Okay, when there's memory consolidations and memory processes, the adrenergics are at work. The brain needs norepinephrine, okay, to consolidate memories, to remember for acuity, for studying. It focuses you. And serotonin complements that. Those are the aminergic neurotransmitters. We won't get too technical, but that's what I wanted to just to convey to some of you that may understand this. And that is exactly what the brain does. And so then, after this, here we go. This is in the REM. That means when we really go to sleep and we get our dreams during the REM. Here, notice that the same process of memory, it is under diminished fear response. Diminished. So what happens is that, notice this graph right here. I'm trying to get you to down to this, okay, right here. Imagine that this bar in the middle is your memory, the core of the memory's form, and this is the emotional context, right here in red. The emotional context is basically fine-tuned under this condition of decreased stress response, so that your brain is not too emotional when it has to remember things, in a nutshell. Well, that is important because, come in, look at what the imaging studies showed. This is during sleep. This happens during sleep. This is a fellow that has not slept, and he only goes to the memory. This is not deficient because we, in order to remember, we need to tie it to an emotional context. So you can go all the way to chip away the emotional context and not establish the optimum kind of a contextual mix of emotions with memory. Those two functions have to be hand in hand. Don't you remember better when was the last time? I don't know, I can give an example of, for instance, you remember happy memories, remember yesterday, with events, and you feel warm in your heart. Oh, I remember that. That is the type of memory you want to consolidate in your brain. Sleep helps you to consolidate and to mix those two, emotions with memory, by fine-tuning the adrenergic system during sleep. So here we have, and also the byproduct is the amygdala activity, because remember the fear circuitry of the brain? Here's the amygdala. This is in somebody who slept well. And this other brain represents the amygdala that in a fellow or a patient that did not sleep well in this particular study. And so the bars here, it shows you clearly the peak amygdala activation is greatly significant than the patients that slept well, and also the reactivity of the amygdala. This is basically the actions within the amygdala, the organ, and this is the activity of the neuronal force of those neurons reacting here. Very, very significantly different than the fellow who, or the patients that slept well. This is what we see. Those that sleep well tend to have not a smaller, but normal-sized amygdalas compared to those that are sleep-deprived. You guys remember what the amygdala is? It's the fear center of the brain. So fellows that are sleep-deprived tend to be fearful when they evoke memories, put too much emotions into it, because this process has not been done adequately. And so this is another reason to sleep well. I hope you understood this.
So with, and I just wanted to also ask you really quick on this one, what happens if you don't sleep here?
Yeah, good point. Well, she's giving me the cue here. What happens is that this produces neurotoxicity, and so this curve will keep going up, and it will produce an accelerated activity in the neurons and would cause them to die. We don't want neurons to die, do we? Fight the neurogenesis. So sleeping preserves the existence of neurons. Sleep deprivation kills neurons, in a nutshell. Yeah.
So just to summarize what we have said so far, you want to sleep so that you have increased growth hormone. You actually grow when you're sleeping. If we're still children, if we're adults, obviously we're not growing in height anymore, but we are growing neurons. So we have those growth factors happening when we're sleeping. We have antidiuretic hormone released when we're sleeping so that we don't get dehydrated. And also melatonin. So melatonin is your sleep hormone. And it's basically, it increases when it's dark. So you can inhibit melatonin by shining lights in your eyes. So artificial light, screens, you know, looking at your cell phone at night, this will inhibit melatonin, and that will inhibit your sleep. Oxytocin is also improved when you're sleeping. Oxytocin is your bonding hormone. The highest level of oxytocin happens when you have a child, when you're breastfeeding. This is the pro-social hormone, and it creates bonds between humans. So if you're not sleeping properly, you'll have less oxytocin. And prolactin is also produced when you're sleeping, so that's, you know, part of the whole nursing process. So there's a synergy between exercise and sleep. So if you get proper exercise and then you sleep well, this synergistically together will improve your hormonal balance and improve your health. So according to experts and a lot of research, the adults need at least 7 hours. You know, there's some variability, 7 to 9 hours of sleep every night. And then there are some therapies that will improve, you know, if you have a, let's say you live in Alaska or a northern climate where there's less, in the winter you have less light, you can use bright light therapy for that, improve exercise. Also, food restriction enhances the circadian rhythm. Good sleep hygiene. So what does that mean? Good sleep hygiene, basically one of the things is you want to keep your bed for sleep only. You want to have a dark, cool room. You also want to go to bed and wake up at similar times every day so that your body gets in that rhythm of sleep. There are things like if you're having insomnia, there are things you want to do, like reserve your bed only for sleep, not do other activities in your bed like studying or eating. Or I have teenagers who do a lot of, you know, I find out sometimes they're actually spending the whole day in their bed, in their bedroom. Like they're watching YouTube videos and but the whole day is in the bed. Well, then when it gets dark, you know, they're still watching YouTube and doing video games. So of course, there's not gonna be bed associated with sleep. So you wanna associate your bed with sleep and not do a lot of other activities in your bed. And those kind of things are the sleep hygiene, not using caffeine that disrupts your sleep and other stimulants. So improving sleep quality decreases inflammation, decreases the amyloid beta depositions, which are a cause of Alzheimer's disease or found in Alzheimer's disease. And so we want to wake up with determination and go to bed with satisfaction. We want to have good exercise during the day and then go to sleep at night and get good rest. So that is our talk, and we thank you for your attention. We have time for questions, and so we'll get started. There's one behind you. I guess there's some over here. Okay.
I wondered if you were going to talk about dreams. Does that affect your rest? You know, some people dream every night, other people do not dream, and I notice there's a difference between, for me, if I don't dream or if I do dream, it's more restful instead of restless.
If you dream or if you don't dream?
If I do dream, it's more restless.
More restless. I'm not a sleep expert, but consensus of what I have heard talked about in the field is that most of the time you dream every night. It's just a matter of whether you remember your dream or not. So if you get awakened at the time when you're dreaming, it's more likely that you'll remember the dream. So I don't know if that really answers the question, but they say that my husband, we're different. He often remembers his dreams. I often do not remember my dreams. So I don't know.
I think that has to do with a preset. Again, we are based on some things that we have read anecdotally, especially because we specialize in other areas. But what I can tell you is, remember the graph I showed you? That is kind of, let's see, where are we? Here. Relevant memories. A lot of times, I would ask you first, and this is again based on memory, do you remember in which occasions you tend to remember your dreams and in which occasions you do not? If what I'm asking you is, can you recall the events during the day in which you were able to remember your dreams and the events in those days in which at the following night you would not remember your dreams? Do you remember that? What is the difference between, can you recall a difference? We can come back to you if you have you some time to think about that, see if you can draw any parallel, because that can give us a clue of perhaps some bias, although it's not entirely scientifically proven, it can give some clues as to what we're dealing with. But I'm curious to learn from you in this case. So we are.
All right, what about napping? I mean, we're older, and even though we get 7-8 hours at night, sometimes we take a nap during the day. Is that helpful or hindrance?
At least in general, it as you age, the kind of what's considered normal is for the sleep to become less consolidated and more like you're not sleeping as much at night, and so you're napping a little more during the day. That's kind of a normal shift in sleep. But in general, for sleep hygiene, you want to avoid napping. So if you're having a hard time sleeping at night, you want to avoid those naps during the day so that your drive for sleep is stronger. Those chemicals are building up so that it's driving you more towards sleep. Does that answer your question?
At what time of the day do you feel the need for napping, by the way? Ah. We don't see why napping would be detrimental. That has a culture also, and I'm not familiar. I don't think that this culture does. And in America, we don't tend to nap as much. But again, I would tell you.
What do they do in South America?
I can tell you from South America or Europe, by the way, that there's a napping time. Like in Italy, I lived in Italy, and when I was growing up in Peru, there's a napping time where they close down businesses between, I would say, 1 p.m. and 2:30. So an hour and a half at least, or 2 hours. And so you're frustrated as an American. If you go there to shop, nothing's open. But there's an advantage to it. It's a cultural thing that is engraved in their physiology. And it does good to them, actually. I also knew a colleague, a visiting scientist in California from Japan. And he was a senior scientist, which religiously, everybody knew him. He, at 1 p.m., again, you know, he would go in his chair, he had a chair, and just go like this, and he was out for an hour. And then we'd get up, we'd wake up, and he was vibrant as ever. So there's a psychological thing. If napping does good to you, by all means. If you can do it, I would practice. Personally, I would practice it because it is a state of the mind. If I'm convinced that something does good to me, then, right. With limits. I mean, you don't want to nap for an hour and a half either, right? Because, I mean, there are things to do. But I think a 30-minute nap, if it's going to cause you to calm down, and again, it's to calm you down to make you productive. It's like as you take a breather and then are able to exert, I think it's fine. Yeah. I don't know. That's what I would say. I don't know if you have any other suggestions. We have two questions. Okay, there, and then two individuals up here in the front.
Yeah, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's about 10 years ago, and the doctors say part of my brain is dying and not producing dopamine. Is there anything that's helpful for that, to produce dopamine? I mean, I've already had one brain surgery, and this in July I'm getting ready to have another. So, I mean, y'all know anything about that?
Repeat the question.
So, yes, the question was, he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. How long ago, again? 10 years ago. and you're showing some symptoms now. What is good for, I've been told that the brain is dying. You've been told the cells in the brain are dying. What is good to counter that? Basal ganglia, yes. We can answer the question. You want to start?
There's no cure for Parkinson's disease.
Unfortunately.
I think lifestyle changes, though, do, like improving exercise, increasing exercise and diet. Nutrition factors that improve brain health will definitely, I couldn't guarantee it would reverse the disease, but I think that it would at least slow progression.
Yeah, help you. I think you want to understand also the pathophysiology a little bit, as I hear. Oh. Dopamine. Yeah, basically what happens in Alzheimer's is that dopaminergic cells... Parkinson's, the dopaminergic cells are lost. There's
substantia nigra.
There's a death of those cells in a specific area, and the striatum, the substantia nigra is where there's a concentration of dopaminergics. These are neurons that produce dopamine, basically. So they undergo apoptosis, but it's kind of an aggressive form of apoptosis. And so that the regulation of movement, as you would see, it's the one that suffers. And so probably, and your question, as I'm understanding, is how can I allow my brain to produce dopamine? Is that right? So I have some of it, more of it. Think about this. Yeah, it'll be ideal because the cells that are not producing dopamine are not there. And so you want to have more of that. One way to do it, it could be a diet. There are current studies about diet. Also, some electrotherapy, where they activate neurons via electricity. So hopefully they sprout. Exercise, because exercise tend to reverse, at least in the memory areas. I don't know, in the striatum, some research show that it might do some neurogenesis, but it's not proven. The research has not shown promise there. Yeah, and we're not Parkinson's experts, we're not in the field to know the latest research, but there's several trials with different techniques. One of them is electrotherapy, where you induce the brain activity by electricity, hoping that there'll be a sprouting. There's also some implants of stem cells in dopaminergic
areas.
Yeah, that
would be experimental, I would think.
Yeah, but those are strictly experimental in animals. So the research is pushing aggressively towards that stage where this can be tried in humans. We're not there yet, that's the bottom line, yeah.
I have heard that the hours of sleep before midnight count double, is that true? And the hours of sleep before midnight will recharge the hormone or make more sleep hormones. Is that true?
Well, so the question was the hours of sleep before midnight, are they worth double? I believe Ellen White makes that statement. And I would say I don't know of any research supporting that specifically, but it makes sense to me because I automatically wake up when it's light outside. You can ask my husband, I wake up early. So if I'm going to get good sleep, it's always better for me to go to bed earlier. And I don't know, do you find it's better when you go to bed earlier?
As long as you at least sleep 7 hours. Having said that, the caveat is, automatically, all of us humans respond to light, and we're talking about sunlight. So as soon as the sunlight starts to appear on the horizon, we cannot force ourselves to sleep another hour. Now, for us, it's different. Now, for me, it's different. Right now, where we're staying, everything is dark. So I can't tell whether the sun is up yet or not. And so that helps me because, you know, we can stay a little longer. But that's the bottom line. Unless you have a way to cover your eyes, if you must go to bed late, I'm talking about to those of you who work in the afternoon shifts. Let's say you end up at 11 until you get home is 12 and you go to bed 12:30 or 1 sometimes. As long as you can condition your surroundings to allow you to sleep 7 to 8 hours or 7 hours, let's just put 7 as the magic number, then you should be okay. Although, you're right, research-wise, I don't know if sleeping before midnight, but you know what I'm saying? I think it's the length of time
that it's dark, right?
Yeah, that is dark. Before midnight, I don't know, because the whole organism shifts when you shift your lifestyle. If you have to work later, your whole organism shifts also the functioning. Yeah. So that's the best answer, though. I don't know if that satisfied you somewhat.
There's a question over there.
Yes, sir.
No, back there with the microphone.
Well, he's been waiting too. So yeah, let's go back there and then come to you. Sorry, one more.
Hey, I just wanted to know if there had been any studies done for on Parkinson's using omega-3s, hyperbaric chamber treatment, and maybe exercise, specific exercises.
Yeah. I think we would just have to say we don't know, because I don't know.
We read a few trials with omega fat, 3 fatty acids on Parkinson's patients, and the results have been mixed. But you know what I'm thinking? There have been mixed because of the way of the design of the study.
Supplements versus food?
Food. Supplements versus whole foods.
Typically in research studies, they're going to be using supplements because that's convenient for the study.
Right.
However, when you use a supplement for anything, you are not getting your supplement is starting to break down as it's packaged and sent to you. So especially with omega-3, it's starting to break down. So if you get it in the food, like in the whole, flaxseed or chia seed or the other, omega-3 sources, greens, leafy greens, that's going to be more powerful. So
yes,
there's a lot of reasons to eat 3 servings of leafy greens per day. And that's just another one. 3 servings of leafy greens per day, that gives you a lot of nutrition in a lot of ways.
That'd be a sort of a dietary intervention that you can put to test. You can put to the test. Trying to get, like Rhoda said, the whole foods with the higher amount of fat, omega fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids, to preserve or at least the few connections you have, and perhaps then enhance sprouting of neurons or the maintenance of the surviving neurons, then that could be something that would be worth seeing. And you have the opportunity to see enough that would answer partially your question. Yeah.
Yep, the last question here.
Okay, just a comment on Parkinson's. Dr. Michael Greger on his site, nutritionfacts.org, is presenting some of the latest research on the newer drugs that are apparently very useful. On napping, if we lie down immediately after a meal, we can cause trouble with the lymphatic system that might cause a heart attack. And so the napping that Dr. Charles Thomas recommended, primarily for stress meeting, people who are having trouble digesting their food. He suggested if you lie down for a timed 15-20 minutes before your meal, this would be the most helpful time of napping any time during the day. And that would be the most useful type of napping.
That makes sense. And you you brought up this condition. But think about this. I mean, our parasympathetic system is going to be aroused, for digestion automatically. And you will feel sleep, especially if you have a high carb or a high caloric intake, right? And that happens usually on Sabbath afternoons because there's a lot of carb. And it's basically a high-calorie fest that everybody does with love. I mean, I have nothing against the potlucks. But it's up to each of us to watch how much calorie intake we put in, because then we're going to be like, oh, brother, yes, God bless you, but I have to go to rest and honor the Sabbath the way it was written, right? Literally, have a restful Sabbath. And so I think we have to watch, and thank you for bringing that up. It's not the most productive thing to nap. I brought the cultural issue as to why people nap. But that's what, I mean, they actually use an entire hour to basically devote to that, but I think it's not conducive to the best health. I would agree with that. And so you mentioned the website, right? So yeah.
I was going to say that is a good website, nutritionfacts.org.
Yes.
If you're...
we'll put that information tomorrow,
to
by the way.
Search so, for yeah. that and, you know, search for any disease that you might have. It pretty much has all health topics on there with multiple videos. So that's a good website to look at, nutritionfacts.org.
All right.
All right. Thank you all for coming. We will be prayer. Up here if you want to give us your information. Should we end with prayer?
Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So we'll end with a word of prayer. We thank you so much, Heavenly Father, for your mercies to us and all that you've given us. We have so much information in this world now, so much scientific information. It's hard to process everything and to know everything there is to know. But we are fearfully and wonderfully made. You have made our bodies so magnificently. Help us to treat our bodies in the best way we can. And thank you so much, most of all, for your love. And be with each person here. Help them as they're leaving. Help them to remember the things that they're studying and to also sleep well tonight. Amen.
Amen. Thank you all. So we'll be up here if you have any questions. We also have a book that Rhoda already spoke to you about. If you want some of this material be sent to you or come to you, this is the best way we can do it for now. So come on up and let us know.